All right, well, let's go on to religious experience. And we'll probably jam on this for about half an hour or so. We'll see. You never know. You never know in here how long we'll go. That's one of the things that makes it so exciting, at least for me. All right, let me talk about the argument from religious experience. Now, I've in some ways sort of demeaned and denigrated simplistic, know-nothing religious experience arguments. I just know in my knower, and you can't tell me otherwise. But there are ways of giving an argument from religious experience that are rational and can be fairly cogent, especially when combined with other arguments. Because we've argued from the origin of the universe, the larger nature of the universe, some of the smaller subsystems of the universe, design. We've talked about morality, and that's very close to every human being. Every human being has a conscience, and we have a sense of what's right and what's wrong. But when we're talking about the religious experience argument, we're claiming that some people have had some kind of meeting or encounter with God that is best explained not by psychological factors, not by wish fulfillment, not by drug intake, but by God appearing, or we should say more broadly, God manifesting himself. That you have some episodes in human history, in fact, quite a few of them, that are best explained supernaturally. People have encountered the living God. Now, this is a very existentially pertinent kind of an argument. Now, there are different ways of arguing and different types of experience. First of all, if you're talking about a theistic experience and a theistic argument, you have two basic categories, ordinary experience and extraordinary experience. The ordinary experience would be more like, I find that my Christian life, I can make sense of the world, it's fulfilling, and I don't have to put on blinders to be fulfilled. I can understand the world. It gives me a personal sense of meaning and mission and values, and I find the ordinances of the church very encouraging and heartening. And moreover, I see a change in myself over time. And I think the best way to explain this is that what the Bible says about Christ and about salvation is true. Now, this doesn't include any extraordinary experience, which is called a numinous experience, an encounter of a being that is both attractive and frightening, a transcendently, and using this in the classical sense, awesome being, a being who inspires awe, reverence, respect, and a holy fear. That's what the word awesome etymologically means. Okay. I mean like, oh, awesome ice cream cone. Right, something like that. Now, in terms of ordinary experience, I think this may be a kind of entree to further apologetics and further interaction. If Christianity is not real and consequential in your life, why should anyone listen to you? But I don't think it's the end of the argument. Now, telling your story, giving your testimony, is significant, and your testimony shouldn't have stopped on the day you converted. Some people are trying to live off a story that was from 30 years ago. I mean, you should have an ongoing life with God. And given who we are as justified sinners, it's the good, the bad, and the ugly. But you end up coming back to God and giving all credit and all glory to God through the most difficult things. I don't demean those kind of arguments. I don't at all. In fact, you can give an argument sort of from providential signs. I mean, if I would go into my testimony of conversion, a lot of the reason I decided to follow Christ was that it seemed like God was arranging circumstances to communicate something to me that was beyond just reading things. I did read things that were very significant, particularly The Sickness Unto Death by Kierkegaard. And there are parts of that that I marked. I read in the middle of the night, 1976, in Greeley, Colorado, in a dorm room. And I put, this is reading me, when he defined the sinner rebelling against God. It was much more than just reading Kierkegaard. It was Kierkegaard reading me, talking about a type of despair where the despair defines who you are. He called it potentiated despair. So you define your identity by your despair and your hopelessness, and you don't want to give it up because then you would lose your identity. So you, in a sense, curse God because he would take away your identity as a rebel against him. And actually, that was pretty much where I was in my thinking, having read particularly Nietzsche and the idea of the Übermensch, the overman, the will to power, and so on. So that disarmed me. And I began to, when I went home, went back to Anchorage, Alaska, various things happened. It was as if God was sort of triggering signs to tell me I was part of a larger story and that he was after me. And there are various things that happened. I mean, I can just give you a couple of them. I had a dream where, this shows you how free God is to communicate semiotically to you in all kinds of ways. I had a dream where this particular rock performer that I used to like, who's very much immersed in Eastern mysticism and the occult, a guy named Todd Rundgren, who's a has-been now, you've probably never heard of him. But he did a song called I Was Born to Synthesize. And this was a music video way back, like in the 70s. And he's sitting in the lotus position, singing the song I Was Born to Synthesize. And I had a dream where he was sitting in the lotus position, saying I was born to hypnotize. I thought, maybe he's on the wrong side. I remember talking to this friend of mine about a friend of his who was very much into yoga and mysticism. And at that time, I had sort of like 1 foot in Christianity and 1 foot in an Eastern mystical kind of worldview and still sort of entranced by atheism and Nietzscheanism and so on. And he said, I have this guy. He practices yoga. You'd really like to talk to him. And as soon as he said that, we're driving in the car. We see the guy in another car. As soon as he said that. And the guy sees us, and he pulls over, and the guy comes up to us knowingly, and my friend Steve says, we were just talking about you, and the guy goes, I know. You know, something weird is going on here. And there were other things. Let me give one other example. I sent one of my friends a postcard, one of my good friends, Dan Lowe. A lot of my high school friends, half of my high school friends became Christians, half did not. So when I came back from Greeley to Anchorage, you know, here half my friends believers, half are not. And I sent a postcard to one of my friends telling him that I didn't believe in the choice that he had made, but he was still a friend of mine. And through one of the words, friends, was 666 in the postcard. He showed it to me, 666. I had written on this postcard, he said, do you remember putting 666 on this card? I said, no. Do you know what it means? No. He opens the book of Revelation. The only explanation I have to this is that I was trying to underline it on an old manual typewriter, and if you didn't depress the shift key, you got a 6 instead of an underscore. I still don't know exactly what happened. But again, you know, something strange. It's like God was giving me indications. I'd read the Bible, open it to a passage that I was looking for. I didn't even know the Bible. You know, things like that. Now, can you make that a repeatable apologetic method? Of course you can't. The only thing you can do is to pray that God gangs up on people. Right? In terms of the signs, the indications, the life events that occur with someone, you pray that somehow, whatever it is, God gets through. Now, apologetics is a big part of that for many people. It was a rather small part for me, but it did play a role. I had long conversations with people. What does this mean? What is this all about? What about this? What about that? So not just I saw these weird things happen and I said, save me, Jesus. You know, it's not how it works. But that was part of the overall mosaic of things. Now I didn't have any extraordinary experience. You can talk about extraordinary experience in terms of dramatic life changes. You know, people are crack addicts and they pray to receive Christ and they get off crack without any help. Or maybe some people are homosexual practitioners and they become Christians. They have no urges whatsoever afterwards. Praise God when that happens. But it's not normative. You can't count on those kind of experiences always happening. If they do, you'd have to say, well, what explains this? Could it be the power of God? Now, in terms of numinous experience, and this is where philosophers spend a lot of their time, numinous experience is an extraordinary experience, and it has to do with an object that is both entrancing and frightening. Now, this can be interpreted in two ways. One can be that the ultimate experience is that everything is one. That this encounter with a being is best interpreted that the self is identical with God. And you are really experiencing a part of yourself. Mystics in Hinduism and some forms of Buddhism will make this claim. You hear it in the New Age movement all the time. Now, if we're talking about a theistic understanding, then there's a relationship that finite beings are being encountered by a being that overwhelms them, that impresses them dramatically, but a being who can be described, who is not identical to the self. And there's a certain structure to that argument we'll come back to. All right? So I'm kind of laying out the possibilities. But let me give you an argument briefly the book doesn't talk too much about, and that is the argument from yearning. You see this in C.S. Lewis, The Weight of Glory. You see it in Pascal, in some of the fragments. And it's basically the reversal from the argument that religion is nothing but a product of projection. We project what we want on the universe. We project what's not there. The argument is that humans, at some level, yearn for the transcendent beyond what is natural. This is what C.S. Lewis calls joy. And he describes it in his book, Surprised by Joy. These experiences of intense desire, yearning, a sort of brief taste of a heavenly good, but the inability to hold on to it. Sort of like the transcendent is seeping through the cracks of earth and enticing and entrancing people. And the argument is that natural means could never satisfy this yearning, that no amount of wealth, no amount of power, no amount of sensory fulfillment or intellectual achievement could ever fulfill this kind of yearning. Therefore, the yearning for the transcendent is fulfillable by the actual transcendent. Now, you have to make this argument very general, because you can't say that everyone has a thirst for a living, personal, and moral God. It may not even be that developed intellectually. It may just be very raw and very visceral. But the notion is that there is something beyond this world that is ultimately desirable, that a person may have fleeting glimpses of. Now, the Freudians and the secularists and all the atheists merely say, well, human beings sometimes desire what doesn't exist. You can terminate the argument with human subjectivity. And C.S. Lewis said, well, certainly it's true that not everyone who is thirsty finds water, but it would be very strange for people to be thirsty and there be no such thing as water. So the argument is that you look through history, whether you're talking about ancient Greeks or ancient East Indians or whoever it is you're talking about, African culture, there's some understanding that there is a transcendent or a sacred realm and some desire to be rightly related to it. Now, this doesn't mean that we're unfallen beings that are just so thirsty for what's good, true, and the beautiful. You have to factor in Romans 1, that people suppress the truth and unrighteousness. They know that God's there by creation. They have the moral law within them, Romans 2. So it's sort of a push and a pull. We're sort of trying to push down the truth of God. On the other hand, we're trying to pull it out of God. So we have an unstable relationship. Brooks Alexander used to say that in our fallen condition, our quest for God is an escape from God. Because we may desire the transcendent, the sacred, something above and beyond ourselves, but not really want it on God's terms. That is, I want the transcendent to work for me, right? Or I want the sacred to make my life meaningful, basically cut out anything like a cross. So you can't say there's this untrammeled, pure, perfect quest for the infinite. And C.S. Lewis calls that the mouse's quest for the cat. Think about it. But nevertheless, I think there are intimations. The way Pascal puts it is that there is an infinite object, an infinite emptiness that can only be filled by an infinite and immutable object, namely God himself. And I talk about that in the book on Pascal. This has been shortened to the infinite vacuum argument, or the infinite vacuum saying. And I've gotten emails from people, where does he say infinite vacuum? He doesn't. He talks about an infinite abyss that can only be filled by an infinite and immutable object, which would truly fulfill the human person. That's an argument to solicit and stimulate people's interest. It's not a full argument for Christianity by any means, because it's so general. Some inkling of and desire for, however warped, the transcendent. That's an argument from desire. Questions or comments on that? You can use this very carefully with people. You have to be skillful. Because sometimes I think God peeks through in distinctive ways or penetrates our realm. And it may even be through non-religious events. It may be through great works of music, whether it's classical or jazz or something else. Sometimes people realize that they are in the presence of greatness that is not easily explained and cannot be forgotten. Now, if someone has had an experience like that, and usually they'll only tell you about it if you know them fairly well, you might say, well, how do you understand that? What was happening to you? Because sometimes people have those experiences, and they're told to squash them. It's not real. It's merely psychological. It's only a projection of your neuroses or something. Or don't let those religious people know about it. They'll capitalize on it in the wrong way, right? But I don't know if you can think of any examples of this, or maybe something that happened to you before you were a believer. It's an experience that goes beyond the mere hedonistic. Can you think of anything? I mean, to steal a term from Bruce Coburn, a rumor of glory, so to speak? Yeah.
Being a musician for 30 years, it's easily yearly depending on the type of ensemble I'm performing with. If it's a high-caliber musician, it happens fairly often. Moments where there's this synchronicity, if you will, where we're all working together, the timing is good, the pitch is good,
mm-hmm.
We're all communicating the same thoughts, the same feelings, and it's as if time slows down and you're just
Right.
And as a Christian, I can't help but to look at that and think, you know, somehow God is being honored by what is here. This is what it would be like you know, if we're offering this stuff to God.
Right. Some intense beauty, a kind of collaboration that goes very deep, that is beyond what is overtly articulated. Musicians experience this at different levels of different types of music sometimes. Audiences can see it happening on occasion. I remember seeing Pat Metheny interviewed once where he's talking about his group and saying that he says there's a, he sounded extremely platonic. He said, we're aiming at the highest possible level as a group. And the closer we get to the level, the more painful it is because then the level goes higher. It was really almost mystical the way he put it. It was like there is an objective goodness, this time beauty, that we are striving for in our music. And he says, basically, I don't worry about the audience. I'm striving for this ultimate sense of beauty and perfection. So rule out 99% of popular music here. But you're striving for something that's intrinsically beautiful as an ensemble of people with your instruments. And sometimes you get closer to it than other times. And when you get closer, it makes it worse because then you have to go further up. I think he was really talking about an immaterial reality of beauty that sometimes is instantiated or instantiated to some degree. That's not the world of naturalism, folks. By no means can you account for anything like that naturalistically, because you'd have to reduce it all to chemical, physical functioning plus nothing. And we talked about all the problems with consciousness and so on. Can you think of anything else that might be in this category? Kind of a signal of higher meaning. Yes?
Standing on top of a mountain,
Right. Yeah, a sense of the overall majesty of the creation. The creation seems to indicate intelligence, an author, an artist. Some people are very struck by that. And popular culture will basically squash it out of you if you're not careful. So I think one of the things we need to do is try to tend to those things if we know about them in others and give them some categories for understanding. This is God's world. God is a God of beauty. Yes, it's affected by sin, but the beauty still shines through, and you cannot account for it by a big bang out of nothing for no reason. It's far more than that. That doesn't explain what you're experiencing. It doesn't explain what you're observing. What you're observing is a truth about the universe, which speaks to a truth about the creator, the designer, the artist behind the universe. All right. Let me talk about the argument from positive religious experience. Let me deal, maybe, briefly, with monistic or non-dualistic experience. I'll try to come back to this when we get to the New Age movement. But oftentimes you hear that people have experienced oneness with God. And they don't mean that they have worshipped God in spirit and in truth. They mean they have realized their identity as God. Shirley MacLaine was very clear about this years ago in her many, many autobiographies. The woman's written 5 or 6 autobiographies. If you're Churchill, you can do that. Anyway, in one of her books, Out on a Limb, and this was made into a television program, she goes out on a beach and just puts her arms out and yells out into the ocean, "I am God, I am God, I am God." Okay. I can just hear God saying, "No, you're not, no, you're not, no, you're not." But the idea is that reality is non-dual or monistic. Mono from one. So the appearance of duality, diversity, multiplicity, individuality is illusory. It's not finally real. It's the play of Maya or illusion. You are entranced by the veil of ignorance. Now, it's only through these experiences that you can see the ultimate oneness of all things. This is the purpose behind most of yoga. It's the purpose behind much of meditation, is to reverse the normal critical rational thinking of the mind by repeating one word over and over again, a mantra, such that it's meaningless. It has to be meaningless to work. The word Om has no cognitive propositional meaning. It can't and work as a tool of meditation, because you see, the world of propositions, cognition, subject, object, that all involves dualities. True and false, duality. Myself and another, duality. Even good and evil, duality. Okay? So people will claim to have experienced this non-dual reality. Now, can you base a worldview, a worldview on this kind of experience? The idea is that the self views itself as illusory. Now, could this function as evidence? No. Let me tell you why. Because to have evidence, you have to have propositions that support other propositions. Let's say I have claim P, and I cite P, Q, and R as supporting P. You can't have that if monism is true, because all is one. You don't have separate states of affairs, because everything is non-dual, a one without second. And in these mystical reports, people will say things like, "I realized that I didn't exist, and I realized that I was one with God, and that I ceased to exist. And I realized that I was in a realm beyond language and beyond words and beyond form and beyond good and evil." Well, if you ceased to exist and that is the final reality, then you literally are not there and you have nothing to say. Because coming back and giving a report presupposes a world of individual things, events, persons, propositions, logic, and evidence. You've denied all those things at the ultimate experiential level. So this kind of a claim cannot function as evidence for a worldview. Yeah. Well, true, but does your language have a referent? If it has a referent, the terms by which you use the language have to apply to what you're describing. And it can't possibly relate, because the non-dual realm is beyond subject and object. It's beyond logic. It's beyond predication. So you cannot, in principle, use that language to refer successfully, truthfully, to that realm. Especially when you say, this is really the supreme reality. It is the only reality, but it's beyond words, beyond arguments, beyond language. Then there's nothing to say, and you're not even really there. You hear this all the time. These kind of experiences somehow authenticate non-dualism. They can't possibly authenticate non-dualism. Now, what about relational theistic experiences, numinous experiences, where you encounter a being, something like Isaiah 6, where Isaiah saw the Lord high and lifted up, the train of his robe filled the temple, and he saw the angels crying out, the seraphs, holy, holy, holy is Lord God Almighty, and so on. And Isaiah says that he cried out, I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the Lord God Almighty. That is a classical theistic numinous experience. You find others in Exodus 3, Revelation 1, and so on. But that experience, as it's reported, the phenomenology of it, is you have Isaiah. He has an extraordinary experience. It's not an everyday experience. But it's an experience of. It's an experience about. So it's intentional. There is an object distinct from his consciousness. And this object, distinct from his consciousness, objects actually, the angels and God, can be described in language. And the thrice repetition of holy is a Hebrew idiom which means ultimacy or maximality. So, to put it as Anselm would put it, St. Anselm, than which, holier than which cannot be conceived, the ultimate holiness. And he sees himself as ultimately unholy, and he's ruined. And then God makes atonement for his sin through the angel with the tongs and the fire and the altar. I think you remember the account. I have a whole sermon on that, so I have to edit myself. But you find a relationship between God and Isaiah that is very similar to normal perceptual experiences. What's extraordinary about it is the object, not the structure of the experience. Okay, so there are various elements. There are certain conditions that have to be fulfilled to see an object. You have to be awake. You have to be attending. There's a certain cognitive structure to it, intentionality. There's a fulfillment structure. Have you successfully perceived an object? You can determine that with physical objects. In fact, you can apply tests to extraordinary objects as well. And the principle of credulity, unless there is good evidence to the contrary, if person S seems to experience E, S should believe that E probably exists. If you rule out things like a hallucination, or you rule out drug taking or some kind of a trick, then if you perceive something, you should assume that it exists, unless there's evidence to the contrary. There's a private and a public aspect. In terms of these encounters with God, we have several reports of this in the Bible. We have several reports, many reports outside of the Bible. People do not cease to be human beings when they encounter God. They see themselves as sinners. They're overwhelmed, but they don't cease to be human beings, and they don't lose their minds. And they don't lose their ability to communicate something of what happened. Even if some of it may be extremely difficult or even impossible to relate, they can still give you the basic cognitive and phenomenological structure of what happened. That's not true of these non-dualistic experiences. If they do that, they cheat. There's the part-whole relationship. You know, I'm looking at part of this podium. I'm not looking at all of it. No finite human being could experience all of God, but could experience God truly. Moreover, there are tests that you can use. Some people say, oh, good night, when you open the door to mystical experience, people can claim anything at any time. No. If you're making a claim that's self-refuting, such as I was there and I didn't exist, can't be true. Or if you're claiming to experience a God who's impossible, a God who's something like a square circle, that couldn't exist. I mean, we have a larger tradition we're appealing to, other numinous encounters. We also want to talk about the positive effects that would come if you really have an encounter with God. This should change your life for the better, right, as it did Isaiah. The profundity of it, the fact that it fits a body of extant teaching. There's nothing in the revelation to Isaiah that contradicts anything else in the Bible. And there's reason to believe other things stated, affirmed in the Bible, are true. So there are ways of testing, and we appeal to vast numbers of different kinds of people who have had these kinds of theistic experiences. Doesn't mean they're necessarily salvific, but it means they've had some kind of powerful encounter with God, and it seems more likely that at least some of these experiences are veridical, meaning truth-conveying, veridical, then they're all delusory or all deceptive. Now, do people make up mystical claims to impress people? Yes, they do. Do people think they have mystical experiences when in fact they don't? Yes. But can all of the encounters recorded be put into those two categories? I don't think so, especially when you test the experiences. Some people say, well, look, other religious experiences cancel out the theistic ones. Well, if non-dualistic experiences can give no evidence, they can't cancel out anything. Now, the real ball game is going to be between the theistic religions. Let's say Jewish experiences, Christian experiences, and Islamic experiences, Muslim experiences. The ones in the Bible and the Hebrew scriptures are incorporated into Christianity. Muslims are not supposed to encounter God. It's against the Quran, because God is so infinitely holy and so removed, he would not deign to reveal himself in that kind of way in an encounter, except maybe to Muhammad. So really, that doesn't comport very well. And the Sufis are always getting in trouble with the Orthodox Muslims because they're claiming this sort of intimate relationship with God is imminent. It doesn't fit Islam very well at all. So basically, you have those three religions, and it boils down pretty much to Christianity and Judaism. Yes? Right. Yeah, that's not a good test. I mean, you have to stipulate a test that is likely not merely subjective. That is, you're trying to eliminate experiences that are best explained as pure subjectivity or projection or manipulation, that sort of thing. Well, it's working. Mormons are growing worldwide. The only problem is they deny the gospel. Now, intellectually, what you need to say is, look, all right, I've now heard the Mormon worldview, or part of it. They don't give you the full body, the full stuff, the first shot. Now, let's see if I get a warm experience when I pray. Okay, I do. So the entire Mormon theology is true. Talk about a bogus epistemology. I mean, good grief, we haven't even looked at the lack of evidence for their claims about free history in America that's in the Book of Mormon. We haven't talked about their polytheism. We haven't talked about their extra books. We haven't talked about the character of Joseph Smith as a polygamist and all the rest of it. Just, okay, I understand what you're saying, and I got a warm feeling, so the whole blasted thing is true. That doesn't really follow. It's not the kind of test I'm thinking of here, see. It's too simplistic. It doesn't follow. And you don't, as a Christian, you don't want to use this argument in isolation from other arguments. It's part of a cumulative case argument. Furthermore, no one has to have a numinous experience to be a Christian. We're just claiming that some people in the Bible and maybe some other people have had them. And if you've had them and they have the same cognitive phenomenological structure as sensory perception, and if they're not intrinsically irrational, and if they're not subject to what are called defeaters, that I realize, you know, I was on a drug at the time, it was hallucination, or I was almost starving, and I could chalk it up to abnormal brain chemistry, then there's good reason to think that at least one person has encountered this supernatural numinous being. Okay? That's the argument from the extraordinary. Now, there's the other arguments about the ordinary, maybe a dramatic change of life, but nothing supernatural in this numinous sense. And then there's this sort of providential semiotic argument where God gangs up on people and shows them various things about themselves and things about himself that seem improbable apart from some kind of intelligence doing this. Actually, it's kind of an intelligent design argument with respect to providence concerning specific individuals. Because when all these things started happening to me, I was having these dreams and someone showed me that I wrote 666 and didn't know it. And this spiritual guy on the dark side I see now wants to talk to me. And I started thinking, you know, this is shaping up to be sort of a battle for my soul. That's how I saw it. There are two sides to this. And it's shaping up that I've got a side on one side or the other. So I was really interpreting signs. So I guess it was almost kind of an intelligent design argument with respect to a specific person and a multiplicity of signs, which included the Bible, dreams, encounters with people, conversations, and so on. So see, there's even an intellectual structure to that. I usually tell people my conversion was not that intellectual. When you come down to it, it was in some ways. It got a lot more intellectual after I started studying. There's a comment over here. Yes.
I'm a former Mormon myself, and probably
Oh, yes. Sure. Well, I mean, within the Christian worldview, you have the doctrinal test, 1 John 4, test the spirits to see whether or not they're from God. And if any religion denies that Christ has come in the flesh, and that's a shorthand phrase for John, meaning his Christology, the Christology of John 1 and 1 John 1 and all of what John wrote, and the Mormons do that, then it's not of God. Test the spirits. So yes, it's also possible, and when we come to the New Age movement, I'll talk about this more, spiritual warfare, spiritual deception. Powerful experiences can be wrought by powerful spiritual beings other than God and who are from the dark side. I mean, Charles Manson. Remember Charles Manson? You might be too young. The cult leader who inspired people to go out and murder in his name, including the actress, what was her name, Bianca? Sharon Tate, who was pregnant at the time. And she was stabbed to death. This is a man who thought he had become one with Brahman. Thought he'd become one with the ultimate reality. And so he had transcended good and evil. I talk about this in Unmasking the New Age. Well, obviously, the fruit of that is evil. So I couldn't have experienced the ultimate if you're going out and inciting people to commit evil. All right. What are the worth of these kinds of arguments? Well, there can be the first-person kind of evidence where someone has experienced either the ordinary or the extraordinary. But again, it's not the whole ballgame. And let's just do a thought experiment. What if someone sees these various signs and all seems to be pointing towards Christ? And so they say a prayer, they try to come to Christ, as one of my pastors used to say, give as much of themselves to as much of God as they can understand. And then afterwards, they start to have questions. The Trinity, evil in the world, reliability of the New Testament. And they're told, oh, don't think about that. Don't worry about that. Just live on faith. Just live on faith. That's bad news for that person. You can't live off of your conversion experience. Can anybody say amen? You cannot live off your conversion experience. You shouldn't even try. There should be some before and after story here, unless you've always believed since you were a small child, as my wife has. There should be some kind of before and after story. But you can't live off your conversion experience. Moreover, you need more than those kind of personal experiences to have a well-developed, articulated, coherent worldview. Because, and I can tell you from horrible experience, there can be long, long periods of time when you know it's true, it makes sense, but you do not experience the presence of God, you do not experience the power of God, and your prayers are repeatedly not answered for months, if not years on end. Then what do? You can't live off your experience. You're not having any. The experiences you're having are the sense of the absence of God, not the presence of God. And I've been there many times. What I have to go back to, and you're not supposed to do this, it's supposed to work the other way around. I'm sorry, I apologize ahead of time. What I go back to is when I don't have the sense of God's presence, God's direction, God's answering prayer, God warming the cockles of my heart every time I open the Bible, or maybe even every tenth time. I come back to this. You know, Grotheis, you spent the last 30 years of your life trying to refute Christianity and you failed. That's basically what apologetics is. You look at the best arguments on the other side and see if your view holds up. So at the end of the day, I think of these books that I've written and I think of the interaction I've had. And yes, experiences are part of it. That's part of the evidence, that how God has come through for me and how God has shown himself to be faithful. But you do have, at least I have, extremely difficult dry times. A lot of them is related to my wife's chronic ill health. At the end of the day, I have to come back and say, this is true. This makes sense. I don't have all the answers to all the questions, by any means, but I have enough answers, and other people have enough answers, that I continue to seek God, trust God. You see, you can't live off your experiences. They're significant. They're important. I'm not demeaning it for a second. Moreover, this may, I don't care how it sounds, it's true. You can't program God to bless you. You can't program God to sanctify you at the rate you want to be sanctified. Now, am I throwing out spiritual disciplines and all that? By no means. But they are not quantitative methods by which to be sanctified. You can't do that. You can seek God. You can try to be honest before God. Cry out to God. Stay in the Scripture. Pray. Have fellowship. Those kinds of things. But they're not formulas. All right. So we can talk about evidence for the person that has the experience. You can talk about, oh, by the way, I should tell you a real powerful, good spiritual experience I had recently, not to get too down. I was watching the third debate. And I'm telling you, it kills me to watch those things. So I developed a new strategy on how to watch it. Excuse me, my wife was in the other room ironing. She wasn't watching. She was listening. And I was pacing back and forth. You know, and Carrie was going, and I was letting out various expletives. And I was thinking, all right, Bush, you need to bring up the fact that all these jobs were lost because you inherited a recession and because of 9/11. He didn't say that in the first debate. So I think, Bush, no, come on, God, tell Bush to say this. Come on. And he did it. He kept doing it over and over and over again. I was psyched. All right. Some of you appreciate that. Some of you don't. All right. Religious experience arguments can also be very powerful for someone who's already a believer. It can be part of the overall confirmation. You know, just hearing accounts of how God has worked powerfully in people's lives when you're not seeing it in your own life, when you don't feel the blessing yourself. That can be encouraging to a believer who's struggling. And again, these arguments should be used as part of given in a comparative fashion. That is, you don't want to bias the case toward theism. Sure, you've got lots of accounts from other religions, but if it's non-dualistic, they can't serve as evidence. And you could even claim that, you know, some Jewish mystics after the coming of Christ had some encounter with God. It doesn't mean it was necessarily salvific. They might have had an encounter with God for whatever reason God had in mind. So I don't think that cancels out Christian experiences. I don't think it cancels out the gospel if, in fact, that sometimes occurs. Yeah.
I wanted to share an experience that my mom had. She manages several banks in California and is accountable for the balance at the end of the day.
Uh-oh.
And recently it came up several $1,000 short. And that was the bank that she was at that day, and she didn't really pay for her job. Several days went by, and nobody found anything out. She prayed, and she had a dream. And she basically saw a specific person that works at the bank, one of the five people. So, the loss of the Christian, and she went and told him, God told me you did it in the dream, and I really believe it's true. They went and confronted the guy and confessed up.
Amazing. Yeah, God is still free to do that kind of thing. And what's the best explanation for that? An all-knowing being took something someone could not normally know, gave it to the person, and it was confirmed. I mean, that's the best explanation, intelligent design kind of an argument. And it also shows that God does supernaturally reveal things to people today. But of course, you know, if someone gets a so-called supernatural revelation, if the Trinity is really a crock, well, then something's wrong because it doesn't fit the Bible, it doesn't fit the body of doctrine that we have inherited and so on. So, as I said earlier, this should be part of a cumulative case argument. It doesn't stand by itself, but it can be used in an evidential fashion. Okay. Questions, comments about this argument, how it can be used, how it can be abused. We'll get back to spiritual warfare when we talk about the New Age. Yeah?
Have you heard of the preacher that was at the lecture who was eating an apple? Have you heard that story?
I'm afraid to.
Well, he was sitting in the back of the lecture hall, and this person on stage was giving this hour-long lecture on why God doesn't exist, why Jesus doesn't exist. And at the end, he asked for questions, and the preacher stood up with his apple, was taking a bite and munching on it, and he said, I want you to tell me if this apple is sweet or sour. The lecturer said, well, obviously I can't I can't tell you that because I haven't tasted the apple. And the preacher said, well, you haven't tasted my Jesus either.
Well, you know, that has some force to it. I'd want to add some more to that. Now, look, if the guy gave some extremely powerful arguments, let's say from evil, or that the Bible was corrupt and full of myths, and you just say, you haven't tasted my Jesus, it's something. May make the person think. But the person might say, why even bite into the apple when there seems to be no evidence for it that's positive?